Hello all monsters, and welcome to Cafe Dead Monsters, your bi-weekly comedy horror podcast. I'm your host Faith as always, and today we've got Cedo with us.
Hi Faith, thanks for having me. I'm a regular listener to the podcast, so it's a real honour to be on and be a part of it, so thank you very much.
Oh, it's very kind of you. It's strange to hear people say they'll listen to me, and I'm like, oh, someone actually wants to hear me.
Yeah, you tend to have really interesting people on, so you know it's great. It's, you're doing good work, and I hope it continues.
Oh, thank you. I needed to hear that. But yeah, this week's episode is about music, whether it's games, horror, or TV shows, or music in general.
Yeah, music's a massive part of all films, but especially in horror films, isn't it? I mean, it's. Music in a film or a movie is designed basically to tell you how you feel, like on an unconscious level, and horror music just it's that plus, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's like whether it's meant to be like an unsettling moment, something that's a bit creepy, or if it's literally like a jump scare is about to happen.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
I do find it annoying when they when jump scare music is used a bit too often.
I always wonder, I'd have to sort of sit down and watch a horror movie on mute to sort of see whether the jump scare would still be as effective. Because you're right, it does have that kind of like kind of sound, you know, or the big, you know, orchestral stab, which is like I'm lost for words. I can't remember the word. A regular feature of horror movies is that, you know, that stab. And I wonder if that's as effective now, or would it be less effective without it? It'd be interesting to see.
I don't know. I think for me personally, if it was used less often in films, I think it would make me jump more. Because every time I hear it now, I'm like, oh, for God's sake, it's going to be another jump scare in about 10 seconds. I'm going to throw myself off the sofa.
Yeah, you're right. Because I usually have to sort of... the trope, that's the word I'm looking for. The trope is the build up, the fake jump, the build up, the fake jump, and then the jump, and then the music is, you know, usually on the second or third one, isn't it? Or like a build up on the second one, and then the stab is on the third one. And it's really nice when it's not there, or if they do it differently, I suppose. But it is a standard trope. I'm going to use that word now.
I do like that word because it's just that there are a lot of tropes in horror, aren't there?
Absolutely, and say music is a massive, massive part of it. I think it's. As I say, it just music is there to tell you how unconsciously you should feel. And I think, obviously, when you watch a horror movie, you want to be unsettled. You want to be on edge. You want something, especially perhaps people like you and I who watch a lot of horror movies, we're probably quite immune to a lot of what we see in terms of gore, in terms of, you know, the fright fests, the fright factor. And but you want the music just to put you on edge just that little bit. And as we'll come on to discuss, in some movies, it's done really, really well. And in other movies, it's done, you know, a bit sort of, dare I say, stereotypically.
Yeah. I mean, like, there's a lot of music cues or particular sound effects that you just hear in films. You automatically know what that sound is from. Like the classic Psycho stabbing noise, where it's like noise like, straight away. You know where it's from.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's like a motif, isn't it? I think one thing that horror movies have in a lot of their things is like a little motif that plays throughout the film, or that has become synonymous with the film, like the bit in Psycho that you mentioned, and like Jaws. You know, it's the simplest thing ever, just a little, you know, cello just playing like two notes, but it's synonymous with the movie. And a lot of movies have that, don't they? Have a little recurring theme throughout it.
I can't think of other films that have that kind of thing.
Like The Exorcist, for example, the Mike Oldfield thing pops up regularly throughout it at key moments. The Omen, Candyman is a great example. Philip Glass did the music for Candyman, and that's got that regular, that little tinkly sort of sound when he's about to appear. Freddy is another one.
Oh yeah, the classic Halloween as well.
And Halloween, absolutely, yeah. I think it's become a staple, and there, again, there are sounds that you associate with them. I mean, I remember growing up having watched The Omen. I always thought wrongly that the Old Spice music was the Omen music, because it's very similar. But whenever I saw the Old Spice advert, I always thought of The Omen, although it was slightly wrong music.
It's an interesting association.
Yeah, I never brought our Old Spice in case, like, a, you know, 5-year-old boy turned up and terrorised me.
Just someone with a really bad bowl haircut. Yeah, oh, no.
Yeah, I want to see your scalp before I let you anywhere near me.
Like, come here, Charles, so I can shave your head. Lovely look. But yeah, when it comes to music being associated with, like, particular characters, I think it was one of my sisters. She, what was it? She watched a video, like, years ago about... it had a particular scene that had Michael Myers in it and had that, like, that classic music score where it, like, appears and, like, freaks people out. And my sister said the music makes him more creepy because otherwise it's just a dude just standing there. She kind of watched, like, the comparison of it being silent and with the music, and it's definitely the music that drives it forward.
Which I suppose proves that, you know, it's effective and it's doing its job. I mean, if Michael Myers was there with a Benny Hill theme, I suppose it would be less effective again, wouldn't it?
I probably think I'm watching the newest scary movie.
No, you're right. And it's interesting when you get the take on people who don't watch horror movies, how they feel when they hear sort of certain soundtracks, especially if it's something they've not seen before. Like, seeing how they respond to it with those sort of little musical interludes and the build-up, which adds to the suspense, I always think is much more interesting, like, representation of what the horror movie does than somebody like, I say, you and I, who, you know, we've seen thousands of horror movies between us, I'm sure, and we're kind of used to it. We know what to expect, but it's always more interesting when there's somebody who hasn't done.
Exactly. I mean, even not the music itself, but sound effects in films have made me jump before. Like, oh god, a really funny example was when I went to the cinema back when the movie called The Orphanage was in the cinema. Yeah. Me and some friends were watching it, and for some reason, nothing else in the film made me jump, apart from one particular, well, two things actually. The one where someone gets hit by a car, but the other one was it was a window slamming shut. I'm so easy that sudden loud noise made me jump, and it caused a bit of a Mexican wave in the cinema.
Popcorn everywhere, yeah?
Pretty much, yeah. Like, one person jumped, the other one, like, didn't know what was going on. Someone else, like, jumped up and hit the head in the wall. So, I mean, it was impressive.
That's like 4D. They actually felt the window slam on their head.
Yeah. Dear. 4D before it was even a thing.
I mean, sounds themselves, you're right, in especially in horror movies, can, especially when they come out of nowhere, can be quite, you know, as nerve-wracking as the actual music. Like, take something like the Conjuring series, where there's lots of sudden loud bangs, you know, especially if you're watching it with sort of surround sound on and the bang sort of comes out from behind you, you're like, oh, crikey, what was that, you know, when you see it for the first time. When there's been silence before, I'm always wary of complete silence in a movie because you think there's something coming.
Yeah, I always wonder, like, well, is someone going to start screaming or is something going to jump out of nowhere?
Yeah, exactly.
Another example I can think of, I love watching, like, YouTube videos of, like, behind the scenes and people in, like, sound studios. And I love how creative they have to be in order to, like, make particular noises. Like, the movie Stir of Echoes. There's one particular bit part in the film where someone's, like, nail breaks off and, like, scrapes across the floor.
Yeah.
And for them, when they make, yeah, that was my reaction every time I watched it. I'm like, no. But whenever I watched the making of, and it showed the how they actually did the noise of the nail tearing off, and it was a bit of wet celery being snapped.
A bit of celery?
Yeah, a bit of wet celery.
Oh, wow. I suppose, I mean, when was Stir of Echoes? Early 90s? Late 80s? It's Kevin Bacon, isn't it?
Yeah, early 90s.
Early 90s. So they were still in the realms then of having to be creative with sounds, weren't they? You didn't have digital sound banks and you know, software to make it all, so you still had to be creative. That's one thing I love about just cinema generally in the 80s, is people had to be so creative with everything, with stories, with sound effects, with special effects, because there was no computers, there was no... you know, magic you could wave. You had to do everything for real. I always think they're much more authentic movies from that time in regards to, you know, what they're creating, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you kind of have to think on your feet a bit more about stuff, like how to make the noise of, I don't know, like I mean, back then, you probably, if they wanted like gunshot noises, they probably actually had to fire a gun in order to record the noise.
Yeah, absolutely. Which, you know, would be fun.
Fun, but I don't think you'd be able to get away with it these days, especially with the amount of incidences on sets where gun misfirings happen, and it's like, oof, no.
Yeah. Yes, that was I think unfortunate is the word for that one.
Yeah, definitely. It's the fact that it still happens, that's what upsets me the most.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the linking back to horror movies, there was the whole thing with The Crow, wasn't there, with Brandon Lee. And he's obviously sad sort of passing. I'm still not 100% sure as to what the cause of it was. To be honest, I'm not really that interested because it's just tragic. I'm not really interested in the nitty gritty, but it had something to do with firearms and some kind of miscommunication or someone doing something they shouldn't. I don't really know, but that was, yeah, it was tragic.
Yeah, there was a lot of different theories about it. Like someone had like an actual bullet in the gun. I've heard another theory of someone that they fired too many blanks in one particular area on him, and it just went through the bulletproof vest.
All right, wow. Because they finished that film with CGI, didn't they? Which was, at the time, quite an incredible achievement.
Yeah, they really had to think about it. It's like, well, how are we going to do it justice?
Yeah. And I think, as just talking of The Crow, I think that's one film where we sort of saw, I think in the 90s, we saw like a bit of a different direction for a lot of horror movies with music, with soundtracks. And soundtracks became a big thing, didn't they, in the 90s for... especially horror movies, they had a lot of more like conventional soundtracks in terms of bands. You know, lots of metal bands, especially, were featuring on soundtracks like Resident Evil, another example. I thought that was quite an interesting sort of change of direction.
It was nice. It was good that they knew how to make it interesting towards the actual, to that industry. I mean, the amount of like horror fans I've met that are into like different genres of like metal, thrash, and rock or pop rock and things like that, and it's kind of like when they came up with that idea to put the actual musicians into the room with vocals and everything, they actually knew what they were doing and said, you know what, we know our audience.
Yeah, absolutely. I think horror movies and like heavy metal music or metal music in general, rock music, the two sets of fans are pretty intertwined, aren't they? Lots of metal bands write songs about horror type subjects like, you know, Satan and murder, torture, all that kind of stuff that you'd expect in a movie. Bands sing about like Slayer, for example, probably the ultimate metal band for singing about Satan, murder, torture, death, all that kind of stuff, which could easily be in the latest Eli Roth movie. So
I like that it still creeps up in films every so often, doesn't it, where they actually have like an actual like music track, not just like instrumental.
Yeah, I think it's funny. I think there's like almost like three eras of like music in films. You got like just classic scores like we talked about, like, you know, Psycho and all that kind of era, right up to like the 90s. Then you had like soundtracks becoming like a thing. And then I personally think Charlie Clouser kind of moved the bar again when he did the score for Seven. Obviously, Charlie Clouser, for those that don't know, I'm sure most people do know, is the guitarist in Nine Inch Nails. And he did the score for Seven, which I know is not technically a horror, but the way he did the music for that and the way he scored that was really different. And then he did the OST for Saw. And Saw, obviously, was a groundbreaking horror movie in its own right. But a massive part of that, for me, was the soundtrack. I absolutely love that soundtrack because, again, it's just different. The way he still manages to build suspense and have like the crazy moments, but all with very modern soundscapes. You know, there's not much in terms of like traditional orchestration, is there? It's just, it's a manic soundtrack and it's all very industrial and electronic, and it works a treat for that movie.
Yeah, it kind of, the way you describe it, it sounds a lot like, was it Mick Gordon when he did the soundtracks for the Doom and Doom Eternal sound music?
Yeah, and again, obviously linking, you know, that kind of music and Doom is, a horror game, isn't it? And are you a gamer? I don't know if I've asked you if you're a gamer.
My wife is. I like watching. I like seeing how like things are made and sort of like the if there's a story or if it's like really good artwork, I'm like, oh yes, I'm gonna watch this.
Fair enough. My wife's more of a sort of RPG player, but I love my gory video games in terms of zombie games, especially. Big fan of like Back for Blood and Death for Dead and Dead Island, all that kind of stuff. And actually, that's an area in video games where the soundscapes can be really effective, but they don't put as much music in as they might. Unlike a, you know, like a movie where it's supposed to be a specific mood for a moment. I think in games, you tend to, I mean, you do get a bit of background music when you come to the boss fight or like a key part, but it's not as, I don't think it's been as explored as it might.
Exactly. I think because quite a few games are like live service now, it's a bit difficult to put music in games because of like people streaming it in case like the music becomes like a copyright issue or if there's a situation where like you don't really want to put a song in a game just for the people to like rush through that area and not like, speed run it and just like, oh, only about 20 seconds of the song got played and that was it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I don't think there's been much sort of licensing of songs to games. I mean, that's something maybe the gaming industry could explore. I mean, even like title music could be something. But it's I mean, there are very few game soundtracks that stand out. I mean, I'm a big Destiny player as well, and the music in that game is amazing. Every cutscene is a very, very strongly scored game, even though it's not horror related. But there's not many games like that that really explore that emotional tie to what's going on and to the music. I think a lot of it is quite standardized, I'll be honest with you. It's just very generic, for want of a better word.
Yeah, a lot of horror games, it is more of a, not quite a mood setting, but yeah, it's a lot of the time it is literally like gunshots, stabbing, very meaty, wet noises. It's kind of like there's no actual music involved.
No, that's right. Although it still can be scary. I'm obviously playing the original Resident Evil where there's no sound whatsoever and then suddenly you open a door or you go in a corner and there's a zombie there, which can still frighten the life out of you, which is just as effective, I suppose, because there's just no warning. All of a sudden, bang, there's a zombie there. Having no music is an interesting angle, or no musical cue, no audio cue is an interesting angle for that kind of thing.
Yeah, I suppose it's like to make it more of a realistic situation, like in real life, if something like that happened, you wouldn't have a musical cue.
It'd be great though, wouldn't it? Imagine if you had an app that had musical cues that could foresee what was coming and then play something that went with that moment.
Exactly, like just to let you know, your ex is in the next room and like a particular music goes off, you're like, nope.
I think that could be something, you know. I think music responds to a situation that just from an app, from your phone. That somebody out there, I'm sure, could make it. It'd be brilliant.
Yeah, but knowing how finicky that could be, like the music that could play would be like really awkward.
It'd be entertaining for everybody else, though, right?
Exactly. Like you could literally be crying in the corner, be like a clown music playing from your phone. It's like, now's not the time.
Yeah, I want to see it happen. If anyone's a software developer, I want to see that app. It'd be brilliant.
I want to see it happen. I want to see the testing on it. Just like, how many versions did you have to go through before this thing got launched?
Brilliant. Mentioning absence of sound just there, that's one area of horror movie soundtracks I actually wanted to explore with you, was how effective silence can be in a film. Because it gets used sparingly as an actual tool, if that makes sense. The obvious one being A Quiet Place. And I never really considered... I found A Quiet Place, it's a great film, I loved it, and I found the absence of any music quite unsettling, because you're expecting there to be music, whatever, but it didn't, so it was unsettling. What I found interesting is we watched A Quiet Place with my wife's eldest, who doesn't watch horror movies, wanted to watch a horror movie. All right, I've heard of A Quiet Place, let's watch that. And they found that the silence throughout the film so unsettling, they could only watch it for 20 minutes. And they weren't scared of like the monsters or what was going on, just the fact they were so unsettled by there being no music and no real background. I found that really quite interesting, you know, just relating back to what we said earlier about people who don't usually watch horror movies, how they react to things. I thought that made me realise how effective that was. Does that make sense?
It's like the people that find the absence of sound really like uncomfortable because you're sitting there with your own thoughts. So I suppose if you're watching a film that is just no background music, no nothing, you're literally just hearing what the characters are doing, it is a bit unsettling.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know you've spoken on a previous episode about Skin and Marink, which I watched a couple of weeks ago, and that does exactly that. There's no it's hardly any sound at all, is it? I think it's like four or five lines of dialogue in the whole thing, because it's just silence. And it obviously the film is designed to play on your fears of your own worst fears of insomnia or fear of the dark or whatever. But the fact that there was no dialogue, no music, nothing, that was really effective, I thought, as a tool in that movie.
I haven't actually looked into that film. I have no idea what's involved in it.
It's one of those films where I know it's made on the budget. I mean, I have to applaud the person who made it, because I was looking into it afterwards, and I think it cost them like $10,000 Canadian. It's a Canadian film. Ooh, and it grossed like hundreds of millions worldwide as a result of this film that he basically made in, I'm sure it's a guy. I forget who's made it, but I think it's a guy. He made it in his like parents' house. I filmed it over like 2 days with all these like little cameras with a certain filter. I'm not too technical on cameras, but and the way it was all put together with this cast of like, I think, four people, one lighting guy, you know, it was just complete budget film. But the way he's done it, the way he shot it, is the clever part of the movie. It's not a brilliant movie. I wouldn't sit there and go, yeah, I recommend this film to anybody who just wants to watch a good horror movie. But to anyone who's really interested in cinema and creativity and angles and the way to put something together, then it's very interesting to watch.
It's creative how people can do things on a shoestring budget. It kind of, like, if you give someone like, say, $5,000 and say, right, you can make a feature length indie with this money, do what you need with it, and the amount of creativity people have with that kind of budget is quite outstanding. Like, it's very rare for it to actually be naff.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, you've got to be creative. I mean, there's so many independent film companies. And actually, thanks to your podcast, I got into the Myco companies. I managed to watch Pandemonium, which is on one of the streaming services. And there's lots of small companies like that out there, which are doing really good stuff on a strict budget. I mean, Pandemonium was filmed in an office in central Milton Keynes. And it's amazing what they did for the budget for that movie, and they still made it, you know, an entertaining film from it. So yeah, you're right. Everyone's just been. I think independents are actually more creative than the Hollywood studios. The Hollywood studios are making films for people who don't watch horror movies, whereas the independents are making movies for people who are fans of horror movies, and it's quite exciting, some of the stuff that's out there.
I think one of the reasons why that is because really with high budget films, there's more to answer for when it comes to like talking to like the higher ups, whereas if you're an indie person, you have a lot more control over like where the money goes, where you can go, what kind of budget you have, and you have a bit more say in who you want in your film.
Yeah, and I mean, I suppose it's like any industry, isn't it, where there's an expectation when you get to a certain level and there's a return. It's a return financially is part of that expectation. So when Hollywood makes, I'm not saying Hollywood always turns out bad horror movies, but they're nearly always predictable, or I don't know, there's so many tropes they just employ because they're made for people who don't watch horror movies generally. I mean, that not to like, you know, diss on some of the bigger picture houses are doing good stuff like Blumhouse, but you know, generally the independents are just a lot more, so many different new and fresh angles. It's really cool. I'm loving seeing companies like Myco and what they're up to. It's great.
I have to say, both of them are lovely people. Like MJ and Anna, like, they're just fantastic to talk to. They're just really genuine, and they have so much passion for making horror films and getting people involved and just.
Yeah, I've been following the campaign, the Real Horror campaign for Witch Trial is going on at the moment, isn't it? That's really good. Loads. I know that you're an associate producer. You are going to be on, which is fantastic. And then they get a lot of people on board to support that. I think that's a great way of doing it. Really get everyone involved. It's great.
Yeah, when I read up about it, I was like, oh, thank God, it's a film that's not based on like the Salem Witch Trials. It's somewhere else. It's like, oh, thank God for that. I did say to him that I wish that I could put more towards it and sort of like help out some more, but they said no, don't worry about it, like, you've done a lot already. And I'm like, oh.
Yeah, and the more the merrier, really. I think you know, even if people just put in £5, you know, if 100 people put in £5, that's £500, you know, and that's pays for that's 10% of what they're trying to raise, isn't it? So I think every contribution counts, and it's just great that people can get involved. And some people can only afford to put £5 in, but they want to be involved. And I think the way they're fundraising that is a really smart way of getting as many people involved as possible and making them feel like they're part of something. So when the movie comes out, you feel like, oh, I'm a part of this, and I think that's great.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. It's I'm so glad they managed to get the funding for it as well, because I was just there like, oh my God, my dead heart is actually beating for once. It's happy. it just made me really cheerful, because that was really nice to see that they've actually managed to get the budget for it and the funding. And it's just, I don't know, it makes me really happy knowing that an indie company is actually going, you know what, we're going to do this, and they're actually going to get the money for it. And it just makes me really happy and really proud of both of them.
Absolutely, and they never know when, you know, I mean, the Witch Trial is an interesting story. Obviously, people can check it out for themselves, but the background to it. But imagine if they make the short film and somebody big does pick it up. Actually, we can make a big film out of this. That's those two's careers made. You know, that's them, you know, they're going to be big names. They're going to be able to make bigger films, more of their own sort of things, but with bigger budgets and so on, and give lots of exposure to the actors and actresses that they're using in the movies. Like, could there be their big break, basically, which would be amazing, because all these horror franchises we love all started out as little budget things, didn't they? Like Friday the 13th and Freddy, they're all just ideas. You know, New Line Cinema started because of Freddy, and he was nobody at the time. It was just some guy who had some money who backed a film. And maybe people like Maiko could get a break in that same fashion. I'd love to see that for them. That'd be great.
Yeah. It makes me really happy whenever I see like one of the films that's gone up on Amazon Prime or on Plex, and I'm like, yes, the movies are getting out there. People are seeing it, and it just makes me really happy to see that.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Because obviously, they're getting paid by Prime or whoever the streaming service is, they're getting paid by them, so that's good. That's revenue for them, and that's great. I've made a note here also. We've completely gone off track, but that's cool. I love that.
Yeah, that's fine. It always happens.
No, it's cool. The other sort of, when we talk about like absence of sound and background sounds, I think one of the first brilliant examples of that was Alien, the first Alien film. There's so much silence in that film, isn't there? It's just computers and the ship humming for like big long scenes in that film, which is just so clever and really adds to like the isolation that obviously for Ripley and what you're supposed to feel when you're watching that movie. It was such an original thing at the time, Alien. It's just a brilliant example of absence of sound.
I absolutely love that film series. I mean, the first one I absolutely adore, because like you said, the absence of sounds is really affecting that film. Like, you can almost hear them like sweating.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's just clever. It's just really, really clever. I mean, obviously, it's a classic movie. We know that now. But again, it was done reasonably on a budget. I mean, Ridley Scott isn't Alien. Mm-hmm. You know, he was not anybody that famous at the time. Again, another example of, it wasn't quite an indie film made on a strict budget, but they had a reasonable budget, because obviously Hollywood wasn't doing horror in the 70s. So, you know, he still had to make do on very little, but obviously it made Sigourney Weaver, made Ridley Scott, who's from Hartlepool, so another Englishman done well.
I can think of a couple of examples of like music that is just not done well at all when it comes to being in films. And one particular film, my God, the music in it. The have you ever watched a movie called Open Graves?
No, should I?
It's the film itself is interesting, but there's certain music cues that are a bit like, what, that, like, you have to turn the music, like, your volume down, otherwise you go deaf.
Right. Open Graves.
Yeah. I mean, Eliza Dushku is in it, and it's an interesting film. It's fun to watch. But yeah, there's like one or two moments where, like, the camera's, like, just taking in the scenery and out of nowhere, like, this, like, and just starts playing out of nowhere, and it just, you know, it's loud enough that you can mistake it for like a helicopter falling through your bloody ceiling. So you have to turn the volume down, and as soon as that stops and people start talking, you have to put the volume back up again. And it's like, oh.
I hate it when I do that. There are so many movies where the sound balance is wrong and the sound mix is wrong, but I suppose that's a different conversation.
You just think like, okay, just need to clean their ears out when it came to like getting the sound balance just right? Like, did they just not, were they half asleep, or were they overtired and didn't realise?
Yeah, I find that, especially with movies that are in 5.1 mixes, like the centre channel can either be too quiet or sometimes not too loud, but so many movies I watch where the center channel, where all the dialogue is just too quiet. So you turn it up, and then obviously a big action scene or a jump scene comes along, and yeah, you find yourself turning it back down again. It's actually quite annoying. But
you know. Especially when it's like a gunfight scene, it's like fantastic. I can't. I have to turn the volume up to hear what the hell they're saying, and I know it just sounds police raid in my flat. So I just want to enjoy my... Just let me enjoy the film. I don't... It's just too loud.
I know exactly what you mean.
It's even worse when you can see that the guns have got, like, silencers on them. It's kind of like, well, that was a bit useless, wasn't it?
That's a whole other avenue, isn't it? Like, the sounds of guns. I've seen so many, people have shared things where there's people really getting into the technical aspect of gunfire sounds and saying, oh, the guns in this movie were wrong and the guns in this movie were wrong because it should sound like this. It's like, how technical do you want to get? You know, for the average person watching, you're just enjoying gunfire. You know what a handgun sounds like. You know what a shotgun sounds like. You know what a machine gun sounds like. It doesn't really matter if it sounds like an M16 or an M14 or whatever. I don't know much about guns, but... You know what I mean? I've seen people get so technical about it. It's crazy.
I mean, the sounds of guns doesn't bother me so much. It's when you literally have like a person firing like a gun that has like, what, 6 rounds at most, but they've literally fired it at least like 23 times without changing the clip.
I'm glad I'm not the only person who's noticed that. I've noticed like some guns I know with the clip sizes because they've used them in video games. You think, oh, they're firing a classic police Glock, for example, which is normally 15 round clip, I think I might be wrong, and then you see them fire it like I say 20 times. Hang on a minute, you've clearly run out of bullets.
When you're watching, it's like, okay, either they've modified the gun to hold more bullets, or they just couldn't be bothered to have a shot of him just changing the Glock magazine, that's the one.
Yeah, because it never happens to me playing a video game. I always run out of bloody ammunition playing a video game. I want one of those magic guns off the movies which has like, you know, 50 rounds in a 9 round clip.
Just get a cheat code and just like get infinite ammo.
Oh, the days of cheat codes. Do you remember like the original Doom and Duke Nukem where you could put like God mode on and stuff, and like you could walk through walls, and I don't know if you ever played those sorts of games, but
I used to play like Blood Omen 2 and Azuric and Looney Tunes and just really random assortment of games.
So I grew up on those like first person shooters. And actually, linking back to music, the Doom soundtrack, the very original Doom, all right, it was 8-bit music, but it was actually pretty cool. It was actually quite effective because I suppose it had to be simple. But it was, you know, it's quite a groovy little soundtrack going on for both Doom and Duke Nukem. Obviously Duke Nukem used to quote lots of horror movies, didn't he? I don't know if you've ever played it, but he's famously quoted Evil Dead, Army of Darkness in particular, quite throughout the game, which is quite fun.
I can't think of other iconic sounds. One particular thing that has come to mind, it isn't actually a theme tune, it's just a sound that one of the sound designers on set came up with it. And it's Friday the 13th when it's the ma sound.
Yeah.
And like just that sound on, like, you know, it's like Jason's on the way.
It's very clever. It's a very clever thing, isn't it? Because it's iconic. It's synonymous. You hear that sound, that you're like, someone's gonna die. Do you ever, I don't know if you ever play any like games with Friday the 13th. My wife and I both love Friday the 13th, and we play two games when we watch one of them. One is Who's Gonna Die First. And the other is scoring the deaths out of 13.
I like that.
Every time Jason does a kill, it's like, we'll score it out of 13. Oh, that's only a 7. That's a 9. And that's quite good fun. Completely off topic, but it's a fun game to play. Everyone wants to play along. I'd be interested to know people's 13, scoring 13. So we've only got one 13 score death, because it's just the most outrageous and hilarious death in any horror film. I don't know if you can guess what it is, but...
Oh, God. Is it ever the head-crushing scene with the guy's eye popped out?
That would be probably an 11.
Harpoon gun?
Actually, that's a good shout. No, it's a sleeping bag.
Oh yeah, that's always a good one.
Yeah, I mean, it's become like a bit of a meme sort of thing now, but at the time it was like, that is just hilarious, that's so funny. It's been like parodied several times, but in the context of the, is it part seven, I think it's in, it's just the sleeping bag death, it's just brilliant.
Random fact about that bit was the originally Jason was meant to like hit the sleeping bag against a tree like a few times.
Right.
But someone, I think it was like someone behind the camera said, no, let's just do it the once, so it shows just how strong he is, that he can just kill someone on impact.
Yeah, I suppose he's more effective, yeah, than if he did it like loads and loads and loads of times.
If you do it just the once and then see the body, you're like, oh, they ain't going to get up and walk that off.
No, exactly.
I miss that that used to be a thing where you could just, like, as soon as you get injured, you're like, yep, just going to walk that off, give me a couple of minutes.
Yeah, like all those fights they have, like Bruce Willis has all those fights in Die Hard and survives it. Whereas, like, if someone were to hit me in the way that he gets hit, I'd probably be in hospital.
Exactly. It's like if I sprained my ankle, I'd be out of commission for like a week.
That's the magic of Hollywood, isn't it? They have magic bullets, magic really reloading guns, and magic injuries which don't kill you.
Oh yeah, and what was it? Injuries that are there one moment but disappear the next, and
oh yeah, the good old continuity errors.
A little bit off topic. One thing that does that. It's not a continuity error, but it's just like that's not realistic enough. I know this is a god awful film, but have you seen Friday the 13th, the remake?
I have. Yeah, I've seen it once.
Same. I paid to see it in the cinema, and I've regretted it ever since.
I've only got it because it's part of the box set. I've got like,
God.
I've got the Scream Factory box set, which has got all the Friday the 13ths in it. And for some reason, it's got that remake in there as well.
So that one DVD, you're like, ugh, no.
Yeah, it's just at the end of the box set, just sitting there.
So you can just collect dust while you're in there.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, it's the scene where the main guy gets his face smashed into like panes of glass on the bus. And he gets like, it gets pulled upwards, and you see his face. He's got like the tiniest scratch on his forehead, and you're like, mate, you'd be lucky if you had a face left after all that.
Yeah,
yeah. That one bit's just always irked me. Like the rest of the film's trash, but that bit's just annoys me because it's like that's not realistic. Like, mate, you're gonna need plastic surgery off of that.
No, exactly. Yeah, that film was. Yeah, I think we could probably agree that film was pretty unnecessary. I can only think they made it because they kept making Halloween films and they want to keep Jason top of the leaderboard. If you look at the all-time kills leaderboard, Jason's leading and I think Michael Myers is second, and they're both like way out in front of everybody. So my theory is they keep making these Halloweens and these later Friday the 13ths to keep the contest going.
Maybe. I did wonder if it was going to be like the Universal Monsters situation, like they were going to try and like reboot the entire lot.
Yeah, which would be a bad idea. And I think they obviously quit after one movie, which was a good idea.
Yeah.
I mean, we could probably do a whole episode on remakes and kind of reboots, whatever phrase they want to use. Because especially in horror movies, it, 9 times out of 10, it does not work. It really doesn't. But that's probably another conversation entirely.
Yeah. Sadly, sadly for you, the MK Horrors dibs on that subject.
Oh, do you know what? I think I recall that. That was sometime last year, wasn't it, I think?
Yeah, it's just it's having the chance to sit down and actually go for it, because my brain likes to like come up with all sorts of different ideas. I've got like an Excel sheet with like half a dozen ideas for episodes, and I'm like, ooh, I can do this episode. And then as soon as I think, say, right, let's do that one, my brain comes up with like 5 more, and it's like, damn it.
That's good though. I mean, it is hard, like coming up with fresh ideas for podcasts. It's it's tricky.
I've got enough for, like, subject episodes to last me about another year at least, so I'm all right.
Brilliant. Oh, good for you. Well, I obviously look forward to hearing them.
Oh yeah, just remembered. You know, the in terms of showing music of the time, the Underworld, like the first Underworld film with Kate Beckinsale, the music that was involved in that was very, not only of his time, but it's definitely fitting for that film as well.
Yeah, I can't remember who was on the soundtrack. It's been a while since I've seen that movie, I'll be honest.
Yeah, I think it was quite a bit of like some rock, some, I think, a bit of new metal as well.
Is that the one with the Seether song at the end? Seether and Amy Lee, is that Underworld?
I can't remember.
Different...
Yeah, didn't.
No, I don't.
Makes me want to look now.
Yes, IMDb is your friend.
Yes.
Yeah, no, I do. It's been a while since I saw it, I'll be perfectly honest, but I do remember it being like that. But again, that was another example of that, you know, sort of what I sketched out earlier, a second era of sort of horror type films having more like conventional soundtracks, or more conventional is probably the wrong word, but like modern soundtracks. We're using actual songs, and it works. It does work alongside the sort of traditional like orchestration. I think it does work.
I don't think it is, actually. I can't seem to find it on here.
Oh, I might be thinking of something entirely different. I remember that song being on. I'm gonna have to look it up now. You've got
me. As soon as people start thinking about it, it's kind of like, oh yeah, I need to look at this now, and it's like.
You can guarantee it's an earworm for everybody right now. It's all going along in their little ears.
Everyone's just thinking about it now. It's kind of like, damn it, what songs were on that bloody film?
Let's see. It's either an Amy Lee soundtrack. It wasn't a bad song, actually. I didn't mind Evanescence. They were Broken, that was the song.
Yeah. I like the music video, but I like the song for it as well.
Yeah, I wasn't bad. I mean, I'm not particularly a massive fan of Seether, but I didn't mind. Oh, The Punisher, that's right. It's at the end of The Punisher.
Ah, okay.
There we go. What was the one you just talked about, Underworld?
Yeah.
I love technology, and it's your friend.
Yes, especially when it doesn't need to run an update.
Underworld OST, here we go. Oh, yeah, so you've got Tool on there. You've got Limp Bizkit or Wes Borland. Charlie Clouser. I mean, like, he's a staple of modern horror now, isn't he? I think David Bowie, Skinny Puppy, gotta remember them. Dillinger Escape Plan, oh, of course, yeah, Dillinger Escape Plan were on there. Baby's First Coffin, that's a great song. Well, I'm a bit of a fan of Dillinger Escape Plan. Yeah, that's a pretty decent soundtrack, isn't it?
Yeah, I remember that. Even I think the film stands out to me, but the music definitely does as well. I love the fact that it kind of like they meld together really well, like they kind of fit each other quite nicely.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as sort of horror movies moved into a more like modern style, more, dare I say, sort of gothic look, especially, then that kind of metal soundtrack works, doesn't it, for that kind of look. I know it's like intertwining two cultures, which are almost like stereotypical tropes of themselves, but it works.
Exactly. I mean, I still kind of question the song choices for, what was it, Return to House on Haunted Hill. Like Mushroom Head did a song for that, and it was kind of like, kind of curious about that.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I wonder what it's like when you're writing music for a film, whether you want it to be popular, whether you want it to be effective, whether you want it to be different. It's so hard to write different music for a horror movie now, which is why, like, just going back to Skinamarink, Absolute Silence is more effective because. Nothing will fit, nothing will work.
Yeah, it's knowing how to make it work in a sense that really to create the correct type of atmosphere for the audience. Like, do you want it to be silence? Do you want it to have like sound effects? Do you want it to have like a band actually playing, or do you want like really creepy instruments, or do you want wet celery snapping?
Next time I have celery, I'm going to snap it and compare.
Yeah, just give it a good crunch.
I mean, certainly, I suppose. If you're a producer and you're thinking about the soundtrack, if you are using sort of certain genres of music, are you appealing to that crowd? I mean, for example, again, one thing we probably all did in the 90s when we were buying CDs, we bought soundtracks. And if the soundtrack was full of your favourite bands, then I suppose commercially, it worked. If that was the idea, you know, if Resident Evil is an example, I can think of the first Resident Evil movie. The soundtrack's amazing. And
wait, I love that music.
Yeah, exactly. And they must have, the makers must have gone to, I think it was Roadrunner. I think most of the artists are Roadrunner artists at the time, and said, look, we want to put out this soundtrack. We want to use all these bands. And they obviously got Slipknot, Fear Factory, I think Coal Chamber on there, all Roadrunner bands at the time. And it obviously, as a marketing tool, it worked. But it does work for the film as well, which is probably the more important thing. But I suppose they were thinking of a commercial aspect to sell the film. Like almost like beginnings of multi-level marketing. You know, let's sell the soundtrack and people were going to go and watch the film because it's got Slipknot on it, when the music industry was as big as it was. It's like an interesting take, but it does work and it's a great film.
Yeah, I really like the first one a lot. I mean, yeah, some of the CGI is a little bit, it's of its time, but I like the the effort that they put into, like they did like a zombie school where you had to learn how to walk and move like an actual zombie, and it's just kind of like, I like the effort they put into making that into the film, and also like the designs put for each zombie as well, which is absolutely fantastic. So the special effects and practical effects they did for it, I love.
Yeah, they had the budget for it, so why not? You know, I never really played the games much. I played the first one like when it was out on PlayStation. When like you come to a loading screen, you could go and have a shower and come back, and it was still loading.
Yeah.
So I never really played it after that, to be honest with you. But I loved the movies. I mean, it lost its way after the third one for me, but they were great, and they say the special effects were superb, and they had the budget for it, so why not? And I loved what they did with the story, and I understand it doesn't quite follow the video game story, but it felt more like it was one character's story, wasn't it? It was Alice's story, basically, and her sort of part of the Umbrella Corporation. I thought it was just a really interesting angle to take, and it worked.
Yeah, the in terms of like I'm gonna do something that's kind of like an association thing, where it's kind of like it's not quite on the subject, but it kind of works with it.
Right, because we've stuck to topic all the way throughout.
Yeah. Yay. But yeah, the Red Queen, the fact that it's a little girl and some of the things she says, like her character is very, she stands out as like a bad guy, because it's literally like an AI that is just doing what it's told, what it's programmed to do. But the voice of that character has always given me the creeps. It's that famous line from the film where she says, "You're all going to die down here."
Yeah. Oh, that was great, wasn't it? I thought it was brilliant using a child. And I know, like, is it the second film you find out it was Thingy's daughter?
Yeah.
Who it's based on. But I loved it. And, you know, AI as a sort of scary medium is quite standard now, isn't it? You know, machines going crazy, or dolls like Megan going crazy, whatever.
For me, it's what was it, the AI art absolutely does me nothing, because I always think of the that handshake meme where they tried to program it to do artwork of two handshake doing like a handshake, but it couldn't quite figure out where the hand started and where it ended, and it just ended up being an absolute mess, and I just love it.
Yeah, the machines aren't quite ready to kill us yet.
Like, you can't even figure out it's two hands holding each other, not like five hands moulding together into like a bloody Picasso painting.
Exactly. They can't figure that out. I don't think there's any danger of Judgment Day just yet.
It's kind of like, yeah, Archer on contest, you might win, but in a physical fight, if one turns into a Terminator, it's no chance.
Well, let's hope that doesn't happen. Although like most, as I say, most machines can't even turn lights on properly, so I'm always arguing with Alexa, because it never seems to do what I tell it to do. I'm not a fan of it anyway, but we have it, and it turns on lights, and sometimes it doesn't. But apparently swearing at it doesn't make it turn the lights on anymore, I'm told.
Oh, grief. I mean, I don't like the thought of something like that being in my home. I mean, it's bad enough I know that my phone's listening to me, and I get adverts on YouTube that are like advertising stuff that I've talked about, and I'm like, really?
Yeah, that is quite creepy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of like, yes, I need to refill my deodorant, and I just get adverts for like wild deodorant. It's like, I've already bought this though.
Wow, I'd say maybe it can create a shopping list for you out of the things you talk about. That'd be clever, wouldn't it? A clever use. We're full of app cleverness ideas on this chat. Perhaps we could sell these ideas and make some money, and then make a movie. Who knows? Or give it to Maiko, and they can make a movie.
Oh, that'd be brilliant. Imagine trying to like going up to like people's phones and just shouting into it like, "Fair pay, join unions," and it just kind of comes up with these adverts that are like, what the hell is going on with my phone?
you could prank your friends, couldn't you? But probably not a conversation for the pub.
Oh god, some of the shit you could say down some of your friends' phones.
Brilliant.
Start shouting like single MILFs in your area and just things like that, just to really wind them up.
Oh, in Wellenbury, you do well. Anyway, one thing I was going to sort of pick your brains on, I found Rolling Stone magazine did its top 35 soundtracks of all time. I'm not going to read them all out to you. The sort of greatest modern masters, if you like. And they got a bunch of people, including Mike Patton from Faith No More, to sort of sit around and pick their favourite ever soundtracks. And I just wonder what you might think to them, whether it's something you'd agree with. Or shall I read the top 10 to you?
Yes, please.
Okay, so you got, so in a 10, The Shining, Rosemary's Baby, The Omen, which we mentioned, Nosferatu, that's a very special film, The Thing, then Cannibal Holocaust, Suspiria, that's actually, that was something, a movie I was going to talk to you about, let's come back to that, Candyman, and then number two was Halloween 3, and then number one was Halloween. So Halloween dominating at the top, which I suppose goes back to what we were talking about earlier with the sort of the little motifs and the way they used it for Michael Myers. But yeah, what do you think? Is that a fair reflection of the best soundtracks or whatever?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, definitely. I mean, when did that article come out?
Oh, now you're asking. skip to the top. 2019, October 17th, 2019.
Okay, yeah, I'll definitely agree with that, those ones, because it's like the classics are the ones that you think about the most when it comes to like great music in horror films.
Yeah, it's that association thing we talked about earlier, isn't it? You know, you associate like the Halloween theme as soon as you, or The Exorcist is probably the best one, as soon as you hear Tubular Bells, which was, you know, it was a big selling record in its own right. But you think of The Exorcist every time you hear it.
Mm. I feel like that with the, what was it? The, when she vomits the pea soup. As soon as you hear that vomit noise, you're like, yep, Exorcist.
Yeah.
it's weird how it's like your brain will kind of remember those really random sounds and remember those particular scenes. And it's like, Exorcist, vomit, Damien staring at the camera. Or the bit in The Omen where it's the nanny is on the balcony and says, look at me, Damien, this is all for you. Like, yeah. As soon as you hear that, you're like, right, I know what that's from.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's you see, obviously, movies sampled in music all the time, didn't you? But horror movies have never had that too many memorable lines. It's more an association, like you say, of sounds and little bits of music, which tend to associate moments, doesn't it, rather than specific quotes.
I feel that I think it's difficult to get like the quote right with horror films, because either it comes out as a bit misplaced or really cheesy.
Yeah.
It's rare to say for something to be iconic. I mean, the one thing I can think of where like a saying is like an iconic thing in the film would be that Army of Darkness when Ash shouts out, "This is my boomstick," or where he says "groovy," and it's just little things like that. Like, it's very rare to find films where it doesn't become cheesy, like it did with Freddy Krueger when he, whatever other bloody sentence, he starts saying "bitch," and it's like, oh, for God's sake.
Yeah, he needs to learn another word or two, doesn't he?
It's like, just give him thesaurus.
No, you're absolutely right. I can't. I mean, I can think of lots of great quotes from horror movies because I just seem to have a memory for that sort of thing. But if you were to get people to list 100 quotes from films, I think at the most 8 or 9 would be from horror movies, because it's not what it's known for, is it? It's known more for the sounds and the music. But I was just gonna, one thing I was gonna bring up when I was sort of putting this together, and it was in number four, was it number four? The Suspiria. It's got to be like the maddest example of sound in a horror film, I think, in existence. I watched it for the first time about 6 months ago, I think. And I hated it. I hate to say that because it's a classic, but I hated it. It was just, the soundtrack was just so intense and so mad. It was more music than it was dialogue. But it is, it holds up as an example of like artsy, you know, art house sort of, you know, sort of movies. But it'd be the one film I'd point to people if you want to watch an example of strong soundtracks, shall I say.
I have a few different feelings about Suspiria, because it's because technically it's part of the Three Mothers trilogy.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it's like what was it? Suspiria, Mother of, hold on, I need to get this up right. So it was a trilogy that was done by Dario Argento. So the first one was the original Suspiria, then it was Inferno, then it was Mother of Tears.
I didn't know that.
But yeah, I mean, they're all like a few years apart. Like Suspiria was 77, Inferno was 80, Mother of Tears was 2007.
Okay.
So when they said that they were doing a remake of the Suspiria, I was like, ooh, are they remaking all of them? So it'd be like an official like trilogy box set, and it just never happened.
I just felt obligated to watch, I felt that I hadn't seen much Italian horror. And obviously, Dario Argento, and I'm going to be controversial here, and there'll be friends of mine who'll be screaming at their phone right now, but like his cut of Dawn of the Dead made the film better. And I thought I should really explore his other works. And obviously, yeah, Suspiria was the obvious famous one, and it was available on a streaming platform, so we watched it. But yeah, I mean, the audio is it's an incredible piece of cinema in terms of like what they did with it. But as a story, I have to say I hated it. The acting was terrible, and the overdubs were terrible as well. I mean, I know all Italian cinema anyway is a thing they do. But it was just poor. I'm sorry to say that, Dario.
I can't think I think it was that particular film where they actually had several different people, and they all had like different. They all spoke different languages, so it was very difficult for them to actually talk to each other on set. So I think that's one of the reasons why they had to do like such a big dub over the film, was because hardly anyone understood what they were saying to each other.
Yeah, I think I've read that somewhere. Yeah, they all spoke, because there's German, Italian and English in the film, if I remember rightly. And the Germans spoke German, and the Italians spoke Italians, and the English spoke English. And then they just overdubbed it for export, which is that's weird, isn't it? Because how do you have chemistry with a person who you don't understand what they're saying?
It's kind of like the, what's it, the 70s version of We'll Fix It in Post.
Yeah. But Suspiria, I wanted to bring up particularly when as soon as we thought about like music and stuff in films when we first sort of talked about doing this, and there are a few films that jump out, but Suspiria was the one standout of you know, everything just done mad. The other one was Nosferatu, which also made that list, because that film is so edgy. By today's standards, it's probably relatively tame, but obviously it's a black and white, it's a silent movie, isn't it, essentially? Well, it essentially is a silent movie. There's no dialogue in it whatsoever. But the music is so creepy. It's so just edgy and just mad, and sets the scene so well. You know, you kind of watch that in the dark, and it's quite, yeah, I think it's extremely effective. Especially seeing as there was no dialogue, and it had to be effective.
Yeah, it's using silence to advantage in order to like set the mood with the music.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a great film. A great film, Nosferatu. It's would probably make one of my, I don't know, top 50s or something, or top 20s. I don't know. I think the other sort of aspect of sound design, I wouldn't say maybe it changed soundtracks a little bit, but the whole J-horror revolution in the sort of early 2000s, you know, the whole Tartan Asia, bringing loads of Japanese horror movies and Korean and Thai horror movies over to our audience, was the way they used like technological noises, which was quite different. I think you'd never seen anything or heard anything in the way that they used like these weird screechy, scratchy sounds. They use like obviously like violins and orchestration as well, but some of like the I've just called it tech noise, I don't know the technical term for it, but that really did add an edge, like in Ringu, you know, that weird sort of ESP noise and Ju-on as well. There's all this technology, and it's amazing, but I really think that's worthy of mentioning, because it's just different and puts you on edge.
What put me on edge was the croaking noise as they crawl down the stairs.
The most copied noise in my household, that is.
Oh yeah, my niece used to be able to do that when she had long hair. Like her mum would go, yeah, do the grudge impression, and she'd just like pull her hair out in front of her face and then do the noise.
can you do it? Can you have a go? That's very good. That's very good. Yeah, I'm impressed with that. That was a director, wasn't it? That was Takemichi's, I forget his name. It was his noise, wasn't it? He came up with it.
Yeah, it's kind of like, what's creepy, but it's a sound that is recognisable.
Yeah, it is. It's a distinctive as you know, as Jason's kick, kick, kick. thing. And yeah, I think you hear that noise, and I love it. Again, it's a movie that, especially the remake, which is a remake I would forgive because it's the original director and most of the Japanese cast is the same. It's just got a better budget, better, you know, slightly bigger audio on it, and it's basically just threw Buffy, and Buffy was the Steve McQueen of horror movies. Let's just throw her in and it will sell Japanese movies outside of Japan. But that sound, if you listen to it in surround sound, pops up everywhere just before you're expecting it, so it adds to it. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant and simple sound design, I think.
Sometimes simpler is actually really good for a lot of horror films, because if you put too much music in a film, it kind of takes away from what's going on. Like, you get distracted by it. Like, what was it? There's a particular film that has like a lot of background noise, but I can't remember the name of it. But if a film has like very little noise, but has like, for example, you hear someone's footsteps, or you hear heavy breathing, little things like the human noises that everyone does. Sometimes that can add a lot more atmosphere compared to like actual music.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Again, that's partly why, you know, Quiet Place is so effective, because there's nothing except the odd kind of like or little sound between them as they try and sort of stay quiet.
I mean, it'd be really bad if you suddenly got the hiccups in that movie.
I'm sure that I think you just opened yourself up to a brilliant parody video somewhere. Walking along and one of them hiccups, and then the creature comes out of nowhere. Saves the young boy, but yeah, you know, maybe the husband gets it.
Or if you do, like, if someone surprises you and do like a little surprise fight. God damn it. Either that way, you like crouch down and both your knees pop and it's like, off.
But you're right, simplicity. I mean, we mentioned Jaws earlier. I mean, Jaws is like one of the most iconic yet simple musical motifs in history. You know, it's just a cello playing an open string and then like fretting one note. Dun, dun, dun. I used to work in a music shop, and it's one of the things I got asked for the sheet music for once. I was like, mate, it's a cello playing two notes. Anyway, but it's so effective and so terrifying. You know, you watch Jaws. It's very hard to judge these things by modern standards because obviously everything's moved on a lot. But at the time, just that menacing low note, like two notes, brilliant, and it's simple and massively effective.
I think that's referenced in a hell of a lot of films, isn't it? Like the Jaws music.
Yeah, because it's synonymous. Again, it's you know, we said that you don't remember lines, but you remember moments, and you remember little bits of music from horror films. And yeah, it's one of them, probably one of the most famous. If you ask anybody who doesn't watch horror movies to name a bit of music from a horror movie, most people will come up and go, oh, the bit in Jaws. Dun-dun. You know, that and Psycho, I think, probably the two most famous pieces of horror music out there. And it's like one note or two notes. Crazy.
I mean, are there any like recent films that you've watched where you've gone, I really like the music to this? Or you like there's like a particular background sound or the silence of it that's really gotten to you?
I mean, Saw was the last, I know that, I mean, that film's 19 years old now, but that was the last film that I was blown away by the soundtrack. Because it was so unconventional in that kind of film, and the kind of the manic nature of some of the bits that Charlie Clouser puts in that film to go with like the more manic scenes, it just adds to like the discomfort of, you know, of the film. It's very effective. I think in recent times, because horror movies have so many out there now, and they all tend to go for like, a lot of the sort of budget horror movies tend to go for more conventional soundtracks now, I've noticed. They've moved away from the bands and doing anything radically different, because they're just trying to... Everything's character-driven now, isn't it? Like, you look at Midsommar and all that sort of stuff, and Hereditary. It's all about character and less about creating an atmosphere, I think. Or they try and create an atmosphere through the characters and not much sound. Whereas, like, obviously, traditionally, you've got violins, you've got brass, you've got, you know, all these sort of things going on. So the answer to your question is nothing stands out. I'll probably think of something as soon as we finish recording, but the Saw soundtrack was the last thing that I was blown away by as an original take on horror soundtracks.
One thing that stood out for me was 28 Days Later. So it sets the atmosphere with just the music, like when the main character walking around, and it's just, he's on his own, and you hear really, it's a good way to put it, the music is causing like a form of pressure somehow. Like, you know something's wrong, but you can't put your finger on it.
Yeah, because you almost like you know what's going on, as he does, don't you? You kind of, you're learning what's happening along with, you know, Cillian Murphy, isn't it? 28 Days Later. You're as an audience learning what he's learning, so the music fits that.
I love that when the music actually stops, that's usually when a horror scene happens, apart from towards the end where that music really kicks in. But the a couple of scenes where the infected attack, and it's like the music just stops, and it's like you just hear the gargling and like the shouting and everything, and it's like it makes it that much more uncomfortable because there's no music involved. It's just the noise that people can make.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. 28 Days Later, great film. Well, that's quite old now, isn't it? When was 28 Days Later? 2002, I want to say. Pop quiz.
I'm really bad at pop quizzes.
No, I'm sorry, I wasn't just saying to myself. it is old. So I know that it's one of those movies that sadly they won't be able to ever update in terms of visuals. You know, obviously everything's getting 4K remasters now, and they're taking a lot of older films and making them look amazing. But because it was shot on like a 16mm handycam, 2002, it can't be updated. They can't, the picture can never be, you know, like if you make a movie on 35mm film, you blow it up and the resolution is probably equivalent to like 16K if you blow it up properly. So getting 4K is quite easy, but because it's only 16mm film, it just doesn't have the resolution above something like 720, I think. I've read an article on it, which is a shame. But yeah, 2002 is the answer to the question. So I was padding whilst I found out.
That was a good way of doing it. I mean, I don't feel that it would need a 4K update. I mean, the kind of that gritty texture that it has to it, it suits the film. And if you try to make it look too clean and too up to date, it takes it away from it.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, I can see that. There are times when, obviously, I watch it on, like, I bought it on Blu-ray and it just turned out to be a DVD transfer. And I was upset at the time. But when I did a little bit of homework on it, I found out why. I think when you watch it on a Blu-ray, it does show up the age and the shortcomings of 16mm film. It does show it up, but no, you're right, it does certainly add to sort of the atmosphere and the vibe of it. There's a great shout on the musical score for that, actually. That's a really good shout.
There's a YouTube video I watched recently. I think you'd really it's What Makes Horror Music Scary is by Reverb on YouTube. It's a few years old, but they go into like proper detail about like the atmosphere in horror film, types of music, and they definitely do the subject justice.
Oh, I'll check that out. What makes horror movie scary? There we go. All right, I'll bookmark that. And what makes a movie scary? What makes? Okay, I'll bookmark that on the old YouTube. Give it a listen. Thanks.
It's all right.
I've learned so much from listening to your podcast. Like I was saying earlier, discovering Myco and that Slasher app I think you talked about on the last episode as well. That's been quite cool.
Yeah, I love doing that. I like being able to just sort of like suggest that, like just talk about really random things and people are like, oh, never thought of that, and actually like go and watch it.
Yeah, and that's part of, you know, part of why we do what we do. Some people listening may know I already do a co-host of podcast called The Virosis Show with my best friend Graham, and we cover underground music like metal and hardcore, but all underground stuff, and we have people on and we just try and spread the word, as it were. It's a nice tool, it's a nice position to be in, to be able to sort of expose new acts, new bands, and in your case, new film companies. Cool. It's nice. I feel like you're doing your bit for your community, you know.
Oh, most definitely. Yeah. Okay, so where can our lovely listeners find you?
You can find me on Instagram at zerosignal77. The O is a zero, so Z-E-R-0 signal 77, where I mainly focus on music and promoting the podcast. I do a lot of my own music, varying styles with remixes and some original stuff, sampling lots of horror movies, actually. I started out as a project during lockdown. I just wanted to record a musical project in the style of like DJ Shadow, if people are familiar with him. just taking loads of samples and mashing loads of stuff together and coming up with some tracks. And quite a few tracks ended up with horror movie samples on them, coincidentally. And you can find that at zerosignal77.bandcamp.com. It's all free. It's all up there. And obviously, if there's any bands that want to work with me and doing remixes, I'm really into that. If you think remanufacture, Fear Factory's remanufacture, and the Eagle Eye people will spot that Zero Signal is a Fear Factory song, my favourite band. So it all kind of ties in together quite nicely. And I'm on Facebook as well, at ZeroSignal77.
And you can find Caffeinated Monsters on most listening platforms, Facebook, Instagram, and Slasher app. We also have merch on our Linktree, which is on our social medias. And you can also enjoy some EcoVerse coffee discount using the coupon code CM. Yeah, it's been lovely chatting to you.
Yeah, it's been brilliant. Thank you again for having me. It's been a real honour to be part of this.
It's all right. We'll definitely have to do this again.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'll do some more homework next time.
Yeah, same here. I was kind of like thinking about more films. So it's kind of like, oh, what else I can talk about? And it's like, oh, I can think, oh, I can talk about this. Is that fantastic? Yes.
Brilliant. Yeah, I felt that went all right, actually. Yeah.